Hi, Xian Qi here, Executive Director of Byron Writers Festival. You're listening to the Play Zone podcast series, recorded live at Byron Writers Festival 2023, a weekend of storytelling and ideas held at the beautiful Bangalore Showground on the lands of the Arakwal Bumbabin people of the Bundjalung Nation. This session, titled Black Joy, is an insightful conversation featuring Bibi Backhouse, Maxine Beniba Clark, Nakia Louie and Cheryl Levy.
Yama Garangaru, Yama Madan. Hello everyone, hello to my people who are on the stage and in the audience. Yilu Yambarabin Arakwal Bundjalung Yambarabin Ngawu Wariwandu Yambarabin Arakwal Bundjalung Ngawu. This country is Arakwal Bundjalung land. It always was and always will be their country. And what a joy that we have arrived in a place where I can say that with such passion and in my own language and be applauded. It's nice. We're going to start this session, Black Joy, according to First Nations terms of reference, because those are the terms of reference that I operate in. I don't know how else to do this. Normally what happens is my role as a panel chair is to sit here and read out the bios, and that feels exceedingly white to me, as if somehow all of the things that you did before credit you into a conversation about something like Black Joy that we all own, and no one has more authority over another to say so, and it's not justified by the bio. So we're going to introduce ourselves according to Black terms of reference, First Nations terms of reference. Yeah. And because we're operating according to First Nations terms of reference, I'm going to ask that we follow the terms of reference of this country and my country, which are both matriarchal, and ask the Black woman to go first.
Thank you. I'd just like to acknowledge the traditional owners and elders past and present, and I'd like to acknowledge First Nations people from around the world for their resistance and their spirit surviving colonisation. I say this because I think it's important that when we acknowledge land, we acknowledge why we have to do that, because stories matter and we need to desperately change the narrative of how our nations were built in this country and around the world. So I'm a Gomori and Torres Strait Islander woman. I am a storyteller. And I guess in terms of First Nations references, I reckon my mob would probably refer to me as the little black fella in the village who can only tell yarns. Can't weave, can't dance, can't fish, can't do much. But she can tell.
Got him.
Yeah, can tell a story. You know, poor thing. So that's probably, that's my frame of reference.
Welcome, Nakia, and thank you. Bibi, would you like to go next?
Thank you, Cheryl. Gunyang Adma Ganda, everybody. Bari Bari Adma. Bubangariana Wanyangun. I acknowledge the Arakwal Bundjalung people. It's really beautiful country here. This is my first time on this country, actually, and what an honour it is to be at such an inclusive community event and program such as this. I come from the Bardijawi people, which is the very northwest coast of Western Australia, up near the Nyulnyulan family of languages and tribes, but I've lived in Narum, Melbourne, for over a decade now on beautiful Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country. I am a writer. I am a gay black writer, and I'm also when I'm not writing, I'm doing boring strategies and policies for boring things that don't really matter, but it's wonderful to be here as a writer.
And Maxine.
Thank you. I want to acknowledge being on Bundjalung land today. My inclusion on this panel is such a delightful one, and it's an honour to be on this panel. I'm not a First Nations author. I was born on Gadigal land and I work on Wurundjeri land. My ancestors were part of the transatlantic slave trade, so they originated on the coast of West Africa. My parents were born in Jamaica and Guyana, and they came to Australia in the 70s via Black Britain. So I've come a long way to this land, and to be included on a panel with Indigenous authors is, yeah, incredible. So thank you for my inclusion.
Ngaju Kuma Guamu Muri. I'm a Kuma Guamu Muri woman. My country's in between Cunnamulla and St. George. I want to keep speaking in language, but I realise it actually takes up more time. That doesn't feel so joyful. But I will speak in English because it's faster. I'm a poet. I'm a writer. There's a subtle difference there. We discussed that yesterday. I'm a poet and a writer. And in my daytimes, I also have a job that involves putting that skill to the test of decolonising country and repatriating country from the ownership of the state to the ownership of First Nations people. Yeah, and when you were speaking there, Bibi, I thought, is there not some joy in the less creative endeavours? I'm correcting myself as I say it out loud. Writing policy, is that not generative and creative and joyful in some ways?
Absolutely. I think what I find the most joyful about the job, you know, what we call the 9-to-5, is the fact that I'm still able to write, the fact that I'm still able to pour creative thinking into how problems are solved. And I think maybe I misrepresented my own career in the sense that the strategies and the policies and the work that I do between 9-to-5 or 7-to-3 might not be exciting for everybody, but for the people who are on the receiving end of those strategies and policies, it really is exciting. And, you know, I work for the government and I do that because I want to change the way that the government interacts and works with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in this country. And that, to me, brings me the joy, knowing that I am contributing to that, not necessarily being the paper pusher, but refusing to push paper and wanting to reinvent how Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and First Nations and people of colour in this country receive services or are viewed and deemed by this government.
Thank you. Wanted to reframe that before we went on. And speaking of frames, I wanted to define some of the frame of this conversation. I'd like to call out right off the bat that we borrow heavily from the influence of Professor Chelsea Wadigo, most recently, and that of international scholars like bell hooks in exploring joy, black joy, which itself derives from the experience of black love and blackness overall. Perhaps, as Chelsea said in her TikTok on the same subject, it's important to acknowledge that we speak about our collective and individual joy, but that our core messages are for a white audience predominantly, which is true today too, chief of which is, trigger warning for the white people in the audience, that black joy is not for your comfort or your viewing pleasure. I suspect that everyone on this panel agrees that we're not here to perform our joy for a white audience. And with this in mind, I propose we kick off this discussion with a conversation about what even is black joy. Nakia, did you want to start?
Yeah, that's a really big question that I don't think I can answer. I don't think there is a definitive thing as black joy. I think it's really hard to talk about black joy without, like, I think you can't talk about black joy without talking about white supremacy and the fact that we're all storytellers that work on within a nation where our power structures are defined by white supremacy and colonization. So for me, black joy, it's not so much about black joy and creating space for black joy. For me, my black joy is in my methodology of how I work. My work is coded with black joy and creating spaces for what I would like to think, you know, other First Nations, black people, black women. I think decolonized space may not transform structural inequality, but what it does do is it creates a little room for moments, and within moments you can have radical stories, radical moments. So for me, it's black joy is, I'm a writer who works a lot within the comedy realm. I started doing that because I didn't want to perform black trauma. I work within, I create work that has to be commodified in order to sustain itself because this is a capitalist society. You know, I have to sell tickets. I have to sell things and make money in order to be able to fund my work. So for myself, trying to find a way in which to talk about things like race, trauma, oppression, violence, that in the past, that in the present, and where do we go in the future, I've had to figure out ways to talk about that where I still feel like a human and where I don't feel like I'm having to reproduce that trauma or commodify it. So for me, the joy is in the practice, not so much the outcome. And it's if you know, you know. It's those little moments where you feel that there is a little bit of hopefulness. It's about creative community and space where people feel like they're not alone and having solidarity. So I guess for myself, that is black joy, something I don't want to share.
Mm.
It's more about, it's for me, my work's not really fueled by a journey of trying to create joy or spaces. It's really an outlet for my I say this with a smile, so please laugh with me, but my really deep-seated anger about, you know, kind of the vast inequality we have in the history of this nation that just doesn't get told. Joyful, yeah.
Yeah, there is. There really is a special kind of joy that comes from, for example, when I was preparing for the panel, I was thinking about when do I feel joy? And I was thinking of a poem that I wrote and read about my cousin, Ruby Wharton, who's an activist. And I wrote this poem about black women activists. And it's angry. And sorry, but fuck, that was a joyful poem to write. I love that poem. I love that in my DNA. But for an audience hearing it, it might not feel joyful to listen to, but the joy of writing it, that is a kind of emancipation. And emancipation, like, is that not the ultimate joy of being completely free and what we would do in a fully emancipated moment? What do we do with those moments? While we're living in an oppressed state, we create moments of emancipation and they are joyful. Does this work for you, Bibi, in your practice?
I find it interesting that that First Nations people, specifically in this context of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, that we actually have to label these human experiences and these human notions and motions.
Yeah.
You know, when we, and I suppose the really interesting part about it for me is it's about reclamation in a way, because after and during oppression and suppression and colonization and dispossession and all of those other very ridiculously horrendous but real experiences since white people arrived in this country, we have had to reclaim so much because we've been deemed as sad, angry, traumatized, messed up black people. And so to rewrite our own narrative, we have to then reclaim a black joy.
Mm.
But I completely agree that joy is a process, it's a doing, it's a being, as opposed to an outcome or a destination or anything along those lines where we suddenly arrive at it or with it. And I think that, you know, everything that forms part of the basis to me of being an Aboriginal person stems from a sense of joy. You know, when I think back to being a small little kid, I found joy sitting on my grandmother's lap. Mm. I found joy going out onto country, and it was, you know, I found joy picking shells off the beach, and I found joy being with my black friends in the white Catholic school. So there were all of these different experiences that I had where I was able to just feel and experience things, and they were all contributing to who I was as a black person.
Mm.
And, you know, through my own writing, I write from experience and I write from a memory and something that has moved me or helped to shape me. So if I'm able to write about that, then I'm able to translate that joy into those words, onto those pages, and share that with whoever reads it.
Mm. While you were talking, I went on a bit of a journey there. Do white fellas know how obsessed we are with our grandmums? Do you know this? Yeah. Black people are obsessed with their grandparents and their grandmothers in particular, and it's almost like they become a deity. They are deified in our culture. And I was hearing this, Joy, because I know about your relationship, and we all have one of these relationships, and I was thinking about how it impacts upon, for a black woman, how you look at yourself. So for me, the idea of getting older is joyful. When I look at my face and see my cheeks becoming bigger, I'm like, oh, look, I look a little bit more like my grandma now. When my body changes and it's menopausal and my gait, the way that I walk, changes and I feel the creep, this is joyful. I'm getting closer to a place where I am more, I am bigger, I am revered, I am respected in a way that we could all only hope to be. So there is joy in aging, and this comes from the essence of our blackness. Maxine, is there an equivalent kind of, some kind of sense of joy that you feel that is specifically channeled through your black identity?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think one of the great joys of my life is watching my mother interact with my children.
Mm.
You know, and, you know, my kids, as we speak, are doing their high school musical, which has been running for a week. And, you know, when we went to see it, I kind of wasn't watching the musical. I was watching my mother watch the musical. Just that kind of connection between her and yeah, the understanding that one day I'm going to be in that place and get to be the one that does that watching of the grandchildren is beautiful. Mm. I think one thing that's really common across most black cultures is the use of art as both a joy and a resistance.
Mm.
And, you know, I write across a lot of art forms. I write spoken word, poetry, fiction, nonfiction, and the process is joyful, but also, and you know, I love the way you talk about the white gaze, Cheryl, that idea that you're creating joy or experiencing joy within a black community or in the process of creating work, as opposed to, you know, as this performative act. And I think, you know, the Caribbean is rife with examples of this kind of almost incidental development of black joy along with resistance and black art. And some examples would be, has anyone ever seen capoeira, the Brazilian art of capoeira, which looks like kind of a cross between karate and dancing?
I tried to do it once.
Yeah.
That was joyful.
Very difficult.
Anyone who watched
very
it.
Very difficult, yeah.
So shit.
And this art form came about from people who'd been taken from the coast of Africa, installed on in Brazil, and wanting to pass down warrior moves. You know, how do you pass down your culture when you're in a situation where someone is watching your every move, you're not allowed to congregate en masse in case you, you know, overthrow the plantation? Well, you make it look like dancing, you know, and so that is how this art form actually developed. When you watch it, it just looks like people are dancing around the fire if you're up from the plantation house. And similarly, you know, gospel music. You know, you often kind of, I used to watch, you know, all those kind of terrible trope trauma slave movies that were, you know, on TV 10 years, still are. But, you know, you'd see these church scenes and this kind of music. And a few years ago I was researching, you know, gospel and realizing that a lot of these songs were actually coded messages. You know, this idea of, you know, carry me home, Jesus, the first ship to ever arrive in West Africa, I think it was in Sierra Leone, was called the Good Ship Jesus, Jesus of Lebec, but they called it the Good Ship Jesus. So this idea that people might be singing and be seen by the white community, oh, they're so joyful, and actually what they're doing is passing
down
their
stories.
Yeah, yeah. So that this idea that I think art, I think, and obviously in Indigenous culture, you know, the fact that Indigenous visual art is so world recognized and just carries those stories through, I think it's prevalent in so many Black cultures that art is that, both a form of resistance and a form of joy at the same time.
There are two threads there I want to pick up, and one of them is written down, so I'm going to go with the one that isn't, that you just presented to us, the idea of connection, which is the essence, the central notion of Blackness, connection to country, connection to each other. Do you find joy, Nakia, in connecting to an audience? Is that why you create?
Yeah, look, I think very much, like, as First Nations artists, a lot of my work, I'm trying to create... I feel like I interrogate whiteness, really, to be quite honest, with mostly everything that I do. And that's not to say that it's not a First Nations voice. You know, we work with a lot of First Nations, like, you know, we've done TV shows, podcasts, have an imprint theatre, you know, creating places for First Nations people and non-white people to feel empowered within that discussion, to be able to talk about things in a way that isn't disempowering. And so I think an example of that is connection with audience. Just wanted to respond to what Maxine was saying. You know, I did a podcast called Debutante about, it started as about Aboriginal debutante balls. And my mum runs Aboriginal debutante ball in Western Sydney and Mount Druitt on Darug land, and they're very, very popular. And so doing this podcast, I wanted to be like, why are they so popular in the First Nations community in Australia? Mm. It's like, you know, wearing the white dresses and this very, very classist, sexist, exclusive colonial tradition. So it took me around the world. I actually got to go to the original Queen Charlotte's Ball. I didn't get to go, but they let me stand outside. I wasn't... they literally made me go to an etiquette course, and then I wasn't allowed into the debutante ball, but I could stand outside and watch the debutante.
Did you fail the etiquette course or what?
Yeah, I did. I did okay. I started burping, though, in the middle of it, which was all on record. And it was incredible because I got to speak to... Black mob in the States, where they had a similar tradition with debutante balls, especially on the East Coast and the South. And that, you know, there's documentation of some of those first debutante balls where slaves had, or people who were enslaved, mocking the titles being when they were announced. And then looking back, then going, you know, going around... Coming back to, you know, this debutante ball in Mount Druitt, you see these young people come out into a space where they go, this is Nakia Louie. She's the daughter of, she's Gumroi, Gokongol, the daughter of blah, 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 so-and-so, blah, 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 so-and-so. So you're announcing your history and how your family ended up in this community. And they go, this is, they say their hopes and their dreams. And what was so incredible about that is I think it was taking something that was this very... exclusive thing, this white thing, and then completely fucking it up and
indigenizing it.
Yeah, well, saying we're ruining it for you. Here's this thing that you were having to exclude us, and we're going to make it ours and feel power and resistance and joy in that. When my nan passed away on the last day I was with her, she said on her deathbed to me,
what can you do if you can't laugh? And I've said that every day since she passed away. And she died a very unfair, unjust death. And so I think for myself, going back to your original question, do I feel joy when connecting with an audience? It's great if people enjoy what I do. It just means I can do it more. But what I feel joy is if someone can listen to what I have to say and go, well, if that bitch can... Oh, sorry.
I think I said the F-bomb before. It's okay.
Yeah. If she can say that over there, and I look like her, I feel like her, I have values like her, then maybe I have a little bit of worth in this world as well, and I can share my story too. And then they go and tell their story. So for me, that's joyful, but it doesn't feel joyful, it's just the doing.
Yeah. Modelling agency
for
not just a younger generation, but anyone who doesn't step into their agency or has it stripped from them, modelling how to take it back.
Oh, also, can I just say, a fun fact I learnt during that, I want to say this, that podcast was the first Aboriginal debutante ball was at Town Hall in Sydney in 1968, right after the, 67 referendum. And it was when it was as a protest to protest the laws that Aboriginal people weren't allowed to meet in groups in public. And I thought, what a fucking fantastic display of, if we want to talk about black joy, is that we're going to protest these laws by putting our most undervalued women at the time and today in beautiful dresses and putting them in like this very high status place and going, we're going to celebrate them and say that they're beautiful. And I was like, that to me is just, that was an incredible fact that I learned doing that.
I won't say the end of the sentence, but it's taking me to what's this then? In debutante dresses. Connection. Do we want to stay with this thread?
I kind of want to continue on with that thread, please, because I find what is really fantastic about black people is that we start off by protesting. I mean, it's shit that we have to protest. But it's really fantastic that we can protest and then celebrate that protest and completely transform it.
Like, literally. So in Brisbane, every Invasion Day, we march. There's speeches. There are many, many speeches. And then we march and we stop in the major intersections and we dance them. And then the police don't like this specifically. Well, we don't dance just to piss off the police officers, but we also do stop and dance to piss them off. And then we get to this one section of road where my daughter, who's sitting in the front row, has done this. You run from there for funsies to Musgrave Park, and then there are some more speeches. And then we party all afternoon. And so there's this protest that ends in pure visceral joy.
Yeah. Even if we go back to the 30s, the origins of the first tangible origins of NAIDOC and how those protests that started as a protest against the 26th of January and, 2023, where it's a national celebration that's inclusive of non-Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to celebrate Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So there's these really fantastic notions of reclamation, and you know what? We did have to protest that, and that was shit, but we're going to forget about that because black people are strong, whether you're Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander, or a black nation from a different part of the world. The biggest thread that ties us all together is colonization, because that's what we've all had to resist. That's what we've all had to fight against, and at the same time rediscover ourselves without losing ourselves and our cultures. And it's that celebration, that solidarity that really strengthens the importance of joy for us, and to always be joyful, to make sure that we're feeling it, experiencing it, sharing it, because without it, we would just be the angry black people that we're stereotyped to be.
I can't stop running in a loop in my head. Can't even colonised. I'm not colonised. Can't even colonise. Keep trying. You didn't succeed yet. I want to shift more specifically and directly into your work. And I know we've been talking about this the whole time, but also let's take it to another level about how you either consciously or otherwise have embodied black joy in your approach to your work or your genre or your subject matter. How do you feel that process in your body? I mean embodied in the full sense of the word. Is there a part of your craft, your practice, that is the physical feeling of joy that helps you to write? Maybe a poet can start this conversation a little easier than others.
Is that you calling me a poet?
I did call you a writer and a poet.
No. In my language, we have a term, Lian Ngan, and the closest English translation that we can devise is the coming together of the spirit. You could really closely relate it to your gut feeling and your gut instinct, but in my tribe, we live our lives by our Lian Ngan, and it is a sensation. It's really almost impossible to describe, but it is a complete centering, a physical centering. And we will not do anything unless we feel Lian Ngan. And it's kind of evolved over time. So then, you know, you'll sort of just hear the old aunties and uncles say, oh, my Lian feel no good. It's no good, my Lian. And so now we say that too. Like if I'm feeling sad, I'm like, oh, my Lian's no good. But that's what we use. And everything that I do is decided by my Lian. So there is this physical reaction for me. There is this physical embodiment, this joy that happens. And that's what keeps me doing what I do, whatever that might be.
And let's run through the list of your multidisciplinary practice. Music teacher, pianist, creative director, producer, writer, and most recently writer of More Than These Bones. And I just want to fully stand there in the joy of black excellence across many fields. I literally just got goosebumps then.
Stop it.
But that's got to feel good, right?
Absolutely. There's this kind of juxtaposition, though, this conflict. When I was born, my parents took me out onto country. Because where I was born in this completely random town where my family were stationed for my dad's work. He was a highway architect, whatever they're called, engineer. And
engineer.
If you're not a writer, I don't want to know about it. But so we were just stationed there, and we lived there for a year or two before we moved on to the next town, so that he could engineer the next road. But where I ended up growing up was country that wasn't mine, but we were neighbours to my own country. And so it was very important to my mum, who was Aboriginal, whereas my dad is white, to take me onto country when I was born and meet my aunties, meet my elders, and get this blessing from them, which was then I inherited my skin name, which is Nyalgari. But when I went out there, my birthmark is this little blonde patch of hair, which I was born with. And so when we got out there, it's this story that my mum has told me since I can, as far back as I can remember, which is that when one of the aunties held me for the first time, she, you know, pulled me onto her lap, and she's poking my birthmark, saying, he's a very wise man, he's going to grow up to be very wise, he's been here before. what's interesting is that when I first got told that story as a little kid, I was like, oh, I'm so deadly. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what happened mm-hmm. to me. But what I didn't realise was it was setting me up for such a weighted future where if I'm told as a baby and if my parents are told when I'm a baby that I'm going to be wise, my future is already being charted and mapped. So then if I grow up being anything but wise and anything but a leader, then I'm a failure. Mm. And
double-edged sword, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like when you... everyone has done some kind of reading in self-help wellness, and we all know that perfectionism is an expression of your trauma. So it occurred to me while you were speaking that is black excellence a response to trauma sometimes?
Well, I think it's actually oppression puts you in the gutter on a pedestal, really. Mm. And so there's very little... I'm a big advocate for black mediocrity.
Hey.
Do something.
That's it.
Yeah, you know, I don't think we're able to be, we have to, you have to be excellent in order to be considered equal. And then if you're not, you're not a human. So I have a real issue with the term Indigenous excellence because of that. Mm-hmm. It's great that to have so many non-white males recognised as excellent in this country, but at the same time, why do we have to be excellent to be considered human?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No, that's amazing. Exactly what I was saying was I don't consider myself as excellent. You're the one who just said I possess black excellence. And if that's your opinion, then fucking great. I'm so glad that someone thinks I'm excellent as a black person. I genuinely mean that. But what pushes me forward and carries me forward is I'm just doing what I love doing. Mm. And what I love doing is being creative, writing, creating experiences for someone else to enjoy, whether that was through a theatre show or not, or a poem or a story. And everything that I do is simply to make a difference. And kind of what Nakia was saying before, if another gay black kid out there sees or hears or reads something of mine and goes, oh my God, I can connect to this, then that's my joy. And that's where the excellence for me lies, not in my own kudos, but in the sharing, in the giving, in the doing.
Maxine, you've written specifically for young people. Mm. Is there, as Nakia and Bibi have just shared, a special kind of joy in that?
Definitely. I think that's, I've written across all age groups, but I think writing for young people is, there is joy, more joy for me in the act of creating the work, knowing that it's going to be in the hands of children. And I think also I do a lot of work visiting schools, you know, a lot of my work's on syllabus in the state where I am. And I vowed, I didn't have a great time at high school, so I vowed I would never visit high schools. And then, you know, they don't ask you if they're going to put your book on syllabus, they just put it on. So it's all of a sudden all these teachers
really?
Calling me saying...
No one rings you up?
No. You just suddenly get calls saying, by the way, this is now on the year 12 text list. So I started going into schools and I think, finding those kids who you think this was me. You know, I needed this book when I was there and those moments of connection. And also, you know, I had an interesting experience with my latest book, which is my first poetry collection for children. And there's 100 poems in the book. And I had this question of, there's poems about peanut butter, poems about lollipops. And then there are a few quite heavily political poems. And there are two in particular. One is called Black Boy Joy and the other is called Black Magic, Black Girls. And I thought this is a book of 100 poems. It's going to go to all different kinds of kids. These particular poems are not for all children. You know, they're only for a specific subset of my readers. And I had this event at a bookstore the other day and this girl, she must have been about 10, I said, what was your favourite poem? And she said, I love the one you wrote for black girls. And I thought, she was an Anglo-Australian girl, and I thought the fact that she recognised it was not for her and she enjoyed it and she realised this was a gift from me to black girls, I think the conversation, you know, I kind of, what I get joy in is those conversations when you realise things are starting to shift a little bit, and also joy in, you know, watching Nakia's plays or reading Bibi's book and experiencing other black art and realising that you are part of this movement for change. I think that's the beautiful thing about communities of colour and art, is that we take each other along for the ride. You know, it's not a singular journey.
Mm. Speaking of experiencing black art, who's watched black comedy? So it would have to be the only mass broadcast vehicle for black content, full stop, that has endured for the length of time that it has endured. Like, and you know what we also hate? We hate firsts and we hate onlys, because there is no joy in being singular when you're black. Singularity is not a desired thing. Being the best is not a desired thing, but it also is shamefully perhaps the most enduring mass broadcast.
That's a really great saying I saw on a tapestry at Sydney Theatre Company when I went in to get my first commission. And it was behind, I'll say, Andrew Upton. And he had this big tapestry in his office overlooking the harbour, and it said, "No one wants to be king shit of Turd Mountain." And I just think that sums it up. Like, you're right. Like, you've got to support other people. Like, that's my spirituality. I would say it reached a very large audience.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, one of the things that I love about working within the arts, performing arts, so screen, theatre, podcasting, things, is that you, that as a First Nations person, you know, I am really proud of the black content that's been made in the last 10 years. I mean, it was watching Redfern Now that made me go, oh, I might be able to be a television writer when I was, you know, failing subjects at law school. So, you know, I think there's, it sits alongside a really, really verbose, solid body of work in history that a lot of, you know, you're riding on the shoulders of giants. That's just as a First Nations person in general. So yeah, but I'm it was very impactful in it being a comedy show that reached a lot of people. Yeah.
You're here at the festival with Joan. Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so Joan is an imprint I have that for Alan and Unwin. That's named after my grandmother Joan. If it wasn't for my grandmother, I would never have really felt that I was important or had a place in this world. I'll just tell you a little bit about her, and that hopefully will give you context to the imprint and what I'm about. So, you know, my grandmother grew up with a single black father during the Aborigines Protection Board era. It's a miracle they didn't get stolen. Her mother died in childbirth. She would tell these stories. So then my mum grew up in a tent by the river, because when her father got back from being a prisoner of war in Japan, he got these things called dog tags to say he was an honorary white man. So they weren't allowed to go back to the mission, which was their home. So my mum grew up in a tent by the river. She moved to Sydney when she was 15, when she was told she couldn't go to year 11 and 12 because that wasn't what black kids did. She's fair-skinned Aboriginal woman. So she moved to Sydney to be a nursing assistant. And then my grandma and my grandfather were moved to Mount Druitt, so that's Darug land. They were moving, relocating Aboriginal people from all around New South Wales and outside of New South Wales into urban Sydney. It was a regional area, it's not really urban. People say you're an urban Koori, I'm a Bogan Aboriginal. And you've just done a podcast called First Eat, where I wanted to answer the question, what would a plate of food look like if Aboriginal people, First Nations people, still own the land or had control over food systems? And during this podcast, it was hard not to then look at my own family and my relationship with food and my body. And I look back at the history of my family and I tell you this story of my family. It was because they didn't have a lot of control or freedom over the places they got to call home. They were consistently moved. And that impacted, what we had access to, education, reading, our value in the world. But what it didn't impact was our ability to dream. And that was what my grandmother gave me. So she loved reading. She read everything. She said, you should always be grateful that you're able to read. My grandfather, he wasn't taught to read and write. I was the first person in my family to... I was the second person in my family to finish high school and then go on to university straight out of high school. I was the first. So not first so good, but I think I'm putting it in a context that, you know, coming from... this is very recent. So coming from a community and a family that were able to still create a possibility for myself to dream and create, they did that through laughter and love. So my nana said on her deathbed, she was moved to this housing commission home in St. Mary's where their termites started eating away at the house. And this was in 2010. We wanted the housing commission to fix the house. They wouldn't. There was some bureaucracy involved. And then within a year, she fell through the floor and she was dead. And I had to watch this woman who I love so much. You know, we talk about, we create them deities, die a really, really undignified, painful death. And so, you know, for myself, I wanted to create Joan as a space to give voice to others, to have the legacy of her values live on. Because as I said, the last day that she died, I was the last person with her. I held her hand. And she said to me, smile, Key, smile, because what can you do if you can't laugh? And when I was doing First Eat, I'm talking around about, but when I was doing First Eat, I set out to go, what does a decolonized plate of food look like? I was like, I don't really have an answer for that, but it's happening all around the country. Go listen to the podcast. It's on Amazon, free. Audible, sorry. But I do know what a decolonized table looks like, because in that little home that my family had been forcibly moved to, that they made home despite having their freedom continuously taken away, we would sit at this dining table, and every Friday we would have Chinese food on these little mismatched plates and tablecloths. And at that table, my parents and my grandparents and my elders and my family gave us younger ones a place to feel like we could laugh and be valued and be seen. And I think for myself, that ability to laugh and to feel like you have a place in the world despite what the world throws at you is what gets you through. And so that's what, for me, creating Joan was. I write for screen. I wear a lot of different hats. So I wanted to really start looking at a way to build community in the spirit of something like my grandmother did. Yeah. Mm.
So is the beginning of this session starting to make sense now, that we can't have a discussion about Black joy without discussing Black trauma, and how Black joy is in so many ways an act of resistance to oppression? And it is the answer to the question that many of us have asked ourselves about even engaging in the festival machine. Because it's a machine. How do you have conversations about oppression, violence, colonization, racism, without reproducing their violences as trauma? And you're kind of acting it out on the stage, and that's violent and traumatic. And so it just gets deeper and more complex. Is it discussing Black joy? It's not that simple. You can't be quiet either. Silence is violent. So we can't not have the conversation. So much complexity. How do you wade through it, Bibi?
One of my strongest personal beliefs is... I am who I am, and all I can be is who I am. And if I can't be me, then I'm no one at all. And it's a really big, deep, almost impossible thing to ask an Aboriginal person to not worry about what someone else thinks, or to not worry or second guess or question what it is that they do, what it is they're giving the world. Because we've never been good enough. We've never been good. We've never been great. These are the things that we inherit from this world that we live in. And so this trauma that we speak of isn't just ours. We were born with it, and our parents were born with it, and our grandparents were born with it. So how can we find this joy? How can we live a carefree life? How do we wade through it?
Mm.
How I wade through it, I can only be who I am. And it's taken a lot of hard work and a lot of time. I'm 32 years old, and only for the last few years of my life have I been able to actually operate in a way that I feel is genuine and authentic to who I am. And so that's how I wade through it.
Mm-hmm.
And I take my grandmother's stories and her grandmother's stories, and I weave them into my own, because whatever happened to my great-great-great-great-grandmother happens to me.
Mm.
And what I do isn't just for me. It's for my grandmother. It's for my ancestors. It's for all of the bullshit that they had to endure and experience just so I can sit on this stage right now. And it's so that in three generations, my great-grandchildren will be in a much better position than what I could ever imagine or dream for them.
Mm.
So it's this sense of being genuine, authenticity, kindness, joy, just doing good, being good, because that's how I wade through it.
Is it a good time to ask you to read for us now, please?
Absolutely. Sorry, I was a little unprepared.
Maxine, would you like to start?
Okay.
While you find your piece on your phone there, baby.
I feel like I was.
Maxine's going to read to us from her book, It's the Sound of the Thing, 100 New Poems for Young People.
So I'm going to read one of the poems I spoke about earlier. It's called That Black Boy Joy. And I imagined this as, if you've ever seen kids skipping Double Dutch, there are quite a few poems in this book that I imagined as kind of almost contemporary nursery rhymes. That Black Boy Joy. Show me some of that black boy joy, the hella bling melon and stage deployed. Gimme some of that black boy laugh, ah ha 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 ha, dig it down to your heart. Son, gimme some of that black boy pride, clock 'em in the eye, come and carry it high. Gimme some of that black boy curl, 3B, 4C, taking on the world. Gimme some of them black boy sparts, dropping in the rhyme like your Biggie or Lamar. Big mathematical, coinus on sabbatical, bad black excellence, we're all behind. Show me, son, what you got, jump like Jordan, poise like Barack, and the confidence you're hoarding. Show me, son, some of that black boy joy, the hella bling melanin stage deployed. Son, give me some of that black boy laugh, ah ha 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 ha, dig it down to your heart. Show me, son, some of them carefree ways, sweet black joy for the rest of your days.
Oh.
I was going to read a piece about my grandmother, but I feel that there's only so much joy that I can share and feel about that, because, and it's kind of something that we were discussing yesterday as well about, but you know, when we write something in a moment, we might not necessarily feel the same way in 12 months' time.
Mm.
because we're always evolving. And I think that's one of the beautiful joys of writing, and that we create these little time capsules of ourselves for later reflection. But this is a very recent piece that I'm going to read instead, and it's...
So not from More Than These Bones that's available in the bookshop?
That's correct, or the bookshop that's just up the back there. but this is... It's a reprise of a piece that's actually in More Than These Bones, mm-hmm. and it's a tiny little backstory. I'll try to make it tiny. I can talk, but there's a piece in there called Blood Tree in the Field, which is a dedication to my family, my immediate family, my brothers, sisters, and my parents, and that connection to my family has changed since I wrote that poem, and so this is the reprise for that, which is. There might be a need for a trigger warning in here, but I'm just going to shut up and read it. It's called Blood Tree in the Field Reprise. You were born between the broken moments of lost women and fragile men, and their hands took your own and led you down the garden path of stubbornness, lined with seraphim ornaments and dying flowers, and you tried to take me here more times than you ever should have, and I almost let you, but I think my black blood to your white knew better than either of us ever did. Memories of growing up with you are vivid and current. The rivers and fields and paddocks and tidal creeks, sounds of gunshots and fishing reels, but carrying me through these shallow waters were your closed fists, coated in freckles and calluses, wrapped in leather belts and forcing their way through timber and plaster. You were tough in several senses. You kept regime and routine beyond any reasonable measure, and you weren't afraid to move beyond the boundaries of your stature to stare down beasts and men, and you weren't afraid to tear down the walls of the homes and hideaways of your children and their spirits. I'm your son. I'm the last of the babies you seated and the first one you slaughtered. And if you ever thought less of me, then you should have told me. And if I was invisible, then you should have said something. But you kept your silence and never admitted to me. You wished I was different, but it made me wish the very same day after day. And you kept your love and you gave me your anger and all the things I never deserved or could ever expect from the man who was meant to hold and protect me from the things in this world that could hurt me and threaten my life. The life you once helped give to me, whether by choice or not. But the irony is the world you were meant to protect me from was the one I was born into and held in by the depth of your throat and the weight of your hate. Because what kind of fucking man would decide the fate of a child was to live life wishing for death and fearing the sound of Land Cruisers on gravel driveways and spending the rest of gifted time learning how to adapt to PTSD and borderline and DID. While you sail through the days without care or regret, your children counting the ways you'll never be forgiven. But through your genes, though your genes are mined and our eyes are the same, your hurt and your name live outside my front door, and they aren't welcome in the walls of my heart because we're different to the core of who we really are. And when you stood behind me in the mirror to remind me you're there, I broke the glass into pieces and threw our history to the floor. You are who you are, and I am me, and we're not the same, so maybe we should just set fire to our tree. Thank you.
Nakia is going to read from Black Showgirls, an adaptation of the film
Showgirls. It was a play I wrote it was staged in 2016. So my math isn't great, I'm a writer. Only 8 years ago. And this came from a letter I wrote to myself that's getting staged at Griffin Theatre Company in Sydney in September, a new production. So this is a new monologue in it, and this monologue came from a letter that I wrote to myself after I got a bit of... I had a play called Blackie Blackie Brown on at STC, Sydney Theatre Company, that had a hate campaign started about it before it was even shown. And after I did an episode of Get Cracking, the final episode, and became a target of Andrew Bolt. So this is from the character Shandon at the very end of the play, as she gets back her black dance company that the white company tried to take away. Black Showgirls was created for black women, every black woman, to come and be celebrated in a world that refuses to see them as people. Black women who are the scariest threats because we can never be white men, not even close. Black women whose success is deemed a threat. Black women whose labour is expected but never considered success. Black women whose voices are deemed less or too disruptive to have worth. Black women who are either aunties or gins, sluts or victims, angry or silent, invisible or targeted, excellent or vilified. Black women who aren't included in black or white history. Black women whose self-empowerment is seen as radical because how dare they try to be more than what the world thinks they are. Black women who are tough and strong, who fight for their families and take the brunt of the violence the world throws. Black women who are sexual and in control, who have created and nurtured life and family on this continent for thousands of years. Black women whose love and laughter gives us light when the world is dark. Black Showgirls is for the you've got an Aboriginal nose or you're so lucky you don't have your dad's nose. For the black bitch or Abbo slut or we don't have that shade of makeup. For the you don't sound black or the can you black it up. For the you're pretty for an Aboriginal and the Aboriginal women look like apes. For the they all sniff petrol and the you're different from the other ones. For the black sluts and the black cunts. For the all you used to live in humpies and you wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for us whites. For the skinny ankles and the big bums and the bigger hearts and the bigger minds. For black women who are magic because they are the future. Black Showgirls is for them, because if this world ever changes for the better, it's because black women pulled the fucking trigger.
Hmm.
Yeah. Weird reading your work. I can't really do it.
I love to watch a child making a study of a biscuit, slowly dissecting and testing each physical property, creaminess of centre, elasticity of sticky bits, whether chocolate drops can be prized from within without complete catastrophe, how long a dunk can last before it brings a joyously thorough exploration of deliciousness to a premature end. No subject has ever been so finitely understood by any scholar than the biscuit is understood by the child. Please join me in thanking Maxine, Bibi, Nakia for what was a joyful conversation after all.
And thank you, Cheryl. Thank you.